Gentlemen, welcome to my talk today, which is about legal liability and intrusion investigation. My name is Jennifer Granick. I am a lawyer, and I teach at... Yeah. You say that till you need us. I'm a lawyer, and I teach at Stanford Law School, and my areas of research are computer security and privacy, civil liberties, surveillance, and those sorts of issues. And so what I'm going to do today is talk to you a little bit about how the law might apply to the jobs that most, if not all, of you do every day. So you come into work one morning and you find that your website's hacked, or there's a file on your server that wasn't there before and wasn't supposed to be there. And you have, as computer security professionals, a number of tools at your a number of resources that you can use in order to try to determine who was responsible for this and what exactly happened to your system. And the question that I'm posing to you, or the warning that I'm posing to you, is that many of these tools that you might decide to use have legal implications or legal ramifications for their use, and that you should be aware of what these legal ramifications are. So why are there legal ramifications to these tools? Well, we'll see sort of as we go through the rules that there are many laws that Congress has passed in order to try to protect privacy or protect computer security that also can have sort of a reverse effect of controlling or constraining or tying one's hands when one's doing some kind of investigation. The purpose of my talk today is to highlight for you what these legal problems might be and explain to you what they are. And I'm going to go into, since we have a lot of time together today, I'm going to go into pretty extensive detail about what the law is and how it might apply to you. But if that is, these laws are really confusing and the law is confusing anyway, the thing that you should be taking away, at the very least, from my talk today is that is when it is time to go talk to a lawyer. So, we'll go over, I'll take questions throughout the talk so that we can make sure that people aren't feeling lost or anything, but if that's all you get from the talk, then that's pretty good, but there's going to be a lot more than that in it. Now, I'm going to particularly cover the rules in the United States, because I think most people here probably live and work in the United States. I think the United States laws are most often exported to other countries, and also I know the most about the United States law. But I am familiar with the laws in some other countries as well, so if people have questions about how some other international laws might apply, please, do ask me and let me know. There are a whole different regime of privacy protections in other countries that are quite a bit different from the way that we protect privacy here in the United States, and other sorts of substantive legal differences as well. So, what are the potential legal obstacles or regimes that might restrict computer security incident investigations? Well, I'm going to talk about a couple today. I'm going to talk about the Fourth Amendment. I'm going to talk about fraud laws, illegal interception of or access to data, the unauthorized access computer crime laws, also known as the hacking laws or anti-hacking laws, and laws which regulate the possession of security tools and devices. Let's deal with perhaps what might be the easiest for most people in this room today, the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is my personal favorite amendment. It's rivaled in my mind by the First Amendment, which I think most people have a place near and dear in their heart for, but I like the underdog a little bit, so I really like the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. It protects us against that from the government, really. Government and government agents, people acting on behalf of the government. Doesn't protect you against your employer, doesn't protect you against your mother. My mother's here, actually, right here. No search your room. she's going to do the second half of the talk. It only constrains government and government agents. So if you are not working for the government, and if you are not enlisted by a government agent to do work on their behalf, then the Fourth Amendment's not going to really apply to you. If you are enlisted by law enforcement for them to help them conduct some part of their investigation, they will be really apprised of the rules that, or really hope that they'll be really apprised of the rules that comprise the Fourth Amendment. But let me give you a little brief explanation of it. Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, essentially says that you can't do searching or seizing without a warrant. And a warrant needs to be issued by a judge, and it needs to have probable cause behind it. More likely than probable cause is that there's reason to believe that that there's evidence of a crime that's going to be found or that you're involved in a crime. And that is the general rule, but as with everything in the law, there's an immense number of exceptions to the requirement that searches happen only with warrants. Some of you may be familiar with these already, like hot pursuit is an exception. The kinds of exceptions that might apply in computer security investigations are, one, could be exigent circumstances. Exigent circumstances is an exception that lets you do a search or a seizure without a warrant when there's a chance that the suspect or somebody is going to be destroying the evidence. For example, if you need to secure the evidence, then that's an exigent circumstance. An example from a case that I once had before I did a lot of computer cases, there was a search where the police barged into a house and seized a bunch of crack cocaine. And what they said was that while they were outside at the door, knocking on the door saying, you know, we're the police, we would like your genteel permission to allow us in the house, they could hear from the back of the house the sound of the toilet flushing, and all cops know that the sound of the toilet flushing is people getting rid of the illegal drugs that they have in the house. So exigent circumstances allowed them to enter the house without a warrant and then seize the drugs. Here, exigent circumstances would be somebody has access to this data, they could delete it, we need to download it and get access to it right away. Another kind of exception, which is not exactly an exception, but leads us into some of the other constraints, is the concept of reasonable expectation of privacy. And the Fourth Amendment only protects places or things in which society says there's an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy, where people objectively and reasonably believe that this is going to be something that's going to be free from search and seizure. And the question with regards to computer servers is this particular server that I'm going to do a search on something in which the suspect has a reasonable expectation of privacy? I worked on a case in which the evidence traced back to a computer that was in a student dorm room. And the school officials working, arguably working at the behest of law enforcement, wanted to search this student's computer. And one of the arguments that the government made was that they were allowed to search the computer without need for a warrant because the student had connected his computer to the public school network and therefore he didn't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy anymore in the files that were stored on his personal computer in his dorm room. Now, I objected to that. I thought that that was wrong. It's sort of like saying you don't have an expectation of privacy in your phone calls because you're using the school's long-distance provider. That's a way in which reasonable expectation of privacy and that concept can affect how you might do a search if you are working with government agents. Again,
what was the ruling?
What was the ruling in that? I didn't lose on that ground. I did lose, though. The court said that there were, it was a combination of exigent, the court said there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, but that there was a combination of exigent circumstances and sufficient cause for them to collect what little information they did from the student's machine. And that most of the information that was collected from machines that were owned by the university itself, and the student didn't have an expectation of privacy in those, so they denied my motion to suppress, and that was really bad because that was important for the case. It didn't go that well after that. Okay. In this case, they did not ask the student to sign away his rights, but it is a good point because consent is an exception to the need for a warrant for the Fourth Amendment. And you'll see as we go through almost all of these things that consent is an exception. And you can always go to the person and ask them. Of course, that's not necessarily the preferred method that law enforcement will take because once you know they're on to you, then you can say, oh, no, I don't feel like letting you search my computer right now and go in and wipe the hard drive. So that wasn't a tactic that they used in this particular circumstances. That gentleman in the white shirt.
What were the facts that supported the Fourth Amendment?
This is a, I could go into, the, like, it, afterwards, I could tell you in depth, really, about this case, but this was something where they believed that there was going to be evidence deleted, that evidence would be deleted if they didn't go and seize it now. But I can tell you more about it later, because I can go on and on about that, about that particular case. So, you know, these Fourth Amendment questions are not things where it's black and white. They're what we lawyers call a totality of the circumstances test, which is kind of a special way for, you know, you kind of, the judge knows it when he sees it, or, you know, that kind of thing. We very rarely are able to come up with in the law a rule that just clearly applies in these situations and clearly doesn't apply in these situations, and there's no gray area, because the vagaries of human existence are far too complicated, and it's really hard to figure out what's just in every case. So, you know, the Fourth Amendment is this kind of complicated balancing between the rights and the needs of the government and the rights of people to privacy. You know, from a defense attorney's point of view, I can tell you that we think that the Fourth Amendment test is, if the judge can imagine it happening to him and him not liking it, only then will you win. Otherwise, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. All right, so moving on to things that we might, all other tools that we might think of using in our investigations. What about social engineering? If you have some idea of who attacked your system or where the evidence might be, but, you know, they're not being all that cooperative, can you lie to them to get access to that information? Well, we have kind of two data points on this question, which suggests that perhaps social engineering is fraud. One data point, which we're probably all familiar with, is United States versus Mitnick. In the Mitnick case, Kevin Mitnick and his co-defendant were accused of calling up the people who were employees of the victim companies and telling them they also worked there and getting these employees to give them account information and passwords so that they could access these computer systems. And this social engineering was the basis for the wire fraud counts in the Mitnick case, suggests that social engineering is wire fraud. On the other hand, then why is that? Well, you know, you're looking at this fraudulent purpose. Is it to deprive somebody of the intangible right of honest services or money or something else that's of value? So you're kind of looking at that, and account information can certainly be something that is of value. On the other hand, you have the data point of the United States versus Gorshkov case, where instead of the defendant doing the social engineering, we have the FBI doing the social engineering. And in this case, the FBI had this kind of ingenious plan, which was really, I think, very smart. These two guys were Russians, and the Russian government didn't want to help in extraditing them or finding anything out about them. So the FBI had this great idea, which was to just offer these guys a job in Seattle. So they made this fake company, which they called Invita, which I think is also brilliant. And they said to these guys, hey, we've heard about your skills and we would like to interview you. Why don't you come fly to Seattle and we will? You can give us a demonstration and we'll see how you do. And so these guys came to this fake company and it was all, you know, tape recorded and videotaped. And they had the network totally monitored. And they said, you know, let's see you hack into our systems. And they logged onto their server in Russia and downloaded all of their tools, and all of this was being sniffed. And then after they did their demonstration, the FBI was like, thank you very much, here's the handcuffs, no job, but, you know, we're glad you could come. And in this case, they challenged the search in the case. Not so much on this, not so much for the social engineering thing, but saying, you know, there was a Fourth Amendment violation here. And there was no problem at all with the lie, right? So you may have heard this when the police lied and that was okay. You may have heard this when you were in high school, you know, where if he's a narc, you just ask him if he's a narc and he has to tell you because cops aren't allowed to lie. Not true. They can lie. And it's not fraud. Why? Well, maybe because you're not depriving somebody of money or something of value or something like that. It lacks that essential element of the fraud. I'm sorry? Okay, so this question was, what about entrapment? Entrapment in the law is something very different from what I think we think of as entrapment, just in sort of our normal people think of as entrapment as opposed to lawyers. And what lawyers think of as entrapment is very specific. What it requires is that the government agent, only government agent, induce criminal behavior on behalf of somebody, and that person was not predisposed to the criminal behavior. So what you have to show to get off on an entrapment defense is like, I was totally not going to do this, except he made me do it. This is so unlike me. I'm not predisposed. It's more than like, you gave me the opportunity. And it's like, you know, faced with the opportunity on numerous other occasions, I would never have done this. It's only because you really, you know, you really made me do it. So entrapment is a very difficult defense to make.
Jennifer?
Yes.
With the FBI guys, did they actually, though, use the Russians' credentials to access their server?
Yeah. Just to sort of finish the story of the Gorshkov case, what the FBI then did is they had the sniffed password of these two Russian guys to their server in Russia, and they used that password to log on to that computer in Russia and download all of the stuff they had stored there. Okay, and then what they did is they zipped it up, then they went and got a search warrant after they had already done this, and got permission from the judge to unzip what they had zipped and review the information. So, the defense attorneys thought to themselves, this could be a search problem. So what they did was, they challenged it, and what the court said was, okay, A, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in the Invita computers. Whether they knew it was FBI or didn't know it was FBI, it's not their computer system, it's somebody else's computer system. They don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. They can sniff their system whatever they want. That's totally fine. Okay, fine. So they have the password. But then they went and took the password and they searched these guys' computer in Russia. And they said, well, Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to non-United States citizens outside of the United States. And it may apply to non-United States citizens inside the United States, may apply to United States citizens outside of the United States. These guys strike out on both counts, no Fourth Amendment right in that information. Aha, but once that information is here in the United States, it's here, and for them to search it, they need a search warrant, and they got one. So, that's fine. Question over there? I don't know whether they were using like SSH or something like that, but the thing is, the way, at some point it goes in plain text, right? So if you're on the Invita computer system, at some point you're typing in your password, Jennifer, then it gets encrypted, then it gets sent. So they get it, maybe it's not a sniffer, maybe it's just a keystroke logger, and they get it before it gets encrypted. So, yeah, the encryption didn't help. Yes, actually, see, you guys know all about this. You didn't even need me. The Russians then turned around for the one of the guys, I think. The Russians then turned around, and I don't know whether they have a warrant for him, but I know that they then filed the charges or initiated an investigation against one of the FBI agents for hacking their server. So, yeah, and we're going to get to that. We're going to get to the... Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up. Yes.
Just from your description, it sounds to me like they already searched the data in transit, because you said that they had sniffers on the network. So as they're pulling the data off the Russian server, they're basically searching it. So they've already made it like a second copy. So they're presenting the judge with, oh, well, we zipped it up here, but all I have to do is step over to the machine that was sniffing the traffic, and I've got copies of it there.
Right, so the question is, aren't they sniffing it as it comes down the wire anyway? And you know, the way the courts look at this is not the same as the way that technology people look at it, which is one of the challenges of being a lawyer in this area. I think the technology person looks at it as, hey, they're sniffing it. Like when you do something like any kind of network sniffer, like Carnivore, you're looking it through all the packets. And what the court kind of says is, well, the agents didn't see it. You know, they're only going to, even though, yeah, they sniffed it, they're not looking at that. They're only going to see it when they unzip this file of stuff that they downloaded. And so the network may have you know, sniffed it as it came by, but, you know, they weren't searching it. They weren't looking. Human eyes weren't touching it. Maybe the computer was messing with it, but the human wasn't.
Yeah.
Gather
all the information that I need and then present it to the authorities and say, here,
As a non-government, so the question is, what do I do if I'm a non-government agent? Yeah, you can do the investigation and then turn that information over to government. And the benefit of that is that you may not be constrained by some of the rules like the Fourth Amendment that the government would be if they conducted the investigation from the very beginning. The downside of that is that the government has some very powerful tools like search warrants and wiretap warrants and that kind of thing that you might not be able to have access to without legal process. So that's totally possible. I'm going to take one other question right there, that gentleman, and then I'm going to move on. Can you say that one more time? I'm sorry. So this question is, if I'm non-government, can I do more than a government agent can do, which is a great segue into the next part of my talk.
Somebody said something about, can I go into systems that aren't mine?
No, we're going to talk about that. You have a lot of leeway with your own systems in some way, but you have much, much less with other people's systems than law enforcement might, than law enforcement does as a general rule. So, and here we're going to talk about it. Can you monitor in real time your own system, the suspected intruder system, or the system of a third party to get more information about the attack? And this enters us into an extremely complicated statutory regime called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which I'm going to go through in a crystal clear way that everybody's going to totally understand. Sniffing is an interception of communications, and interception of communications are controlled by the ECPA, Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. The factors as to whether ECPA applies to prevent or allow something are multifold, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of them here for you. One is, are you law enforcement, an intelligence agency, a public ISP, or a private ISP, like business or an employer or something like that, or are you somebody else entirely? Is it your system or another party's system? Are you accessing the content of communications, meaning what the message says, or are you getting traffic data to who it went, who it came from, who it went to, that kind of thing? Are you getting the information in real time as it comes across the wire, or are you getting information that's stored, that's already saved on the file server? And how does this affect the rights of third parties who may not be the intruder and may not be you, but are other people who perhaps are communicating with the intruder? Okay. As a general rule, you are not allowed to intercept or acquire the contents of communications while they're in transit. No sniffing. No unauthorized eavesdropping, sniffing. And once you get information, you're not allowed to disclose it. Okay? So you can't get it, and if you get it, you can't tell anybody. Okay, that's the general rule. As I said before, with everything in the law, there are exceptions to the general rule, and here we have many exceptions. I'm going to talk about these. There's an exception if you get a warrant. There's something called the computer trespasser exception. There's an exception if you have consent of the party. There's exceptions for system providers, which may be the most powerful exception or the most relevant one to you guys. And there's an exception for information which is broadcast in a way such that it is readily accessible to the general public. Okay. Now, again, I'm not going to go too much into the rules about warrants, which law enforcement needs to get to in order to be able to do this. You can't, if one of the other exceptions doesn't apply, you can't do wiretapping without a warrant, which means that you need to have law enforcement cooperating with you. But if you look at what's required for a warrant, as I said before when I was talking about the Fourth Amendment, to get a warrant under the Fourth Amendment, just normal search and seizure warrant, you need probable cause, you need to have it issued by a judge, and you get a warrant and you're cool. For a wiretap warrant, you need to show a lot more. Okay, you need to have, there's internal procedures within the Department of Justice that need to be followed. You can only get a wiretap warrant for certain kinds of crimes, the most serious of crimes, which we call predicate offenses. Those most serious of crimes include things like murder and extortion and RICO Act stuff, you know, with mob stuff, and now also include, of course, drugs, and also now includes, since the Patriot Act, Section 1030, unauthorized access to computers. Yes? has four slides from now. He asked me if wireless would be considered access to the general public, and I think that that is an interesting and important and open question. Because when you have unencrypted wireless, pretty much anybody can pick it up. There's not many cases that interpret that provision of the law, and it has been proposed that perhaps even intercepting the contents of communications which go over wireless might not be prohibited by ECPA because of that provision. Now, when my clients ask me, am I allowed to intercept communications that go over unencrypted wireless, I tell them no, because I don't want them to be the test case for that. But if, that's what they pay me for. But if I were presented with a factual scenario in which someone had failed to ask me ahead of time about that and had already done it, I think that that would be a really interesting and potentially viable defense to raise. Whether it would hold water or not, we don't know. We're going to do some wireless. The hacker court is going to be about wireless, and that's going to be tonight at 6?
4:45 till 7.
At 4:45 till 7. So there'd be more about the law of wireless there. The gentleman in the maroon shirt. The Patriot Act did not, he asked me whether the Patriot Act softened some of these warrant requirements. The Patriot Act did not change this. What the Patriot Act did, mostly in this area of the law, which is dealing with electronic communications, is it took things that used to be harder to get and reclassified them or made it clear that these are things that are easier to get than we might have thought. So things like voicemail, which was once harder to get, is now easier to get than it used to be. Things like billing information or other kinds of subscriber information, a name, address, phone number, used to be harder to get or arguably harder to get, now much easier to get. You can just get it with a subpoena. So a lot of what the Patriot Act did was sort of reclassify some of the things and put them in different categories so that different levels of proof were needed for government to get them. And as I go through, since I know people are interested in the Patriot Act, I'll try to remember to highlight what's kind of new since then. Okay, just a couple other points about the wiretap warrant. You need to have minimization, which means you can't listen to everything. You can only listen to, the stuff that you have to listen, and if it's not about the incriminating thing you're investigating, you can't listen anymore. And the wiretap warrant is for a limited time. So it's much harder to get than the normal warrant.
Jennifer, good question. What about like FBI agents sitting in chat rooms about child pornography, things like that? Do they need any kind of wiretap law?
Okay, so a chat room, for example, is that going to be covered by the wiretap law? And the answer to that is no. And here's why. First of all, you could say it's for general public, right? It's configured for the general public. But sometimes maybe that's not true. Maybe there's passwords or something like that. There's an exception to the rule that says no interception, and that exception is consent. Well, how many people need to agree? Does everybody need to agree, or does only one person need to agree? If I've got, a bunch of people in a chat room, how many of them need to know that I'm the FBI agent, listening in? Well, under federal law, you only need one. Right? So we get one person to agree, you can listen in. And this is often what they do in the same case that I was talking about before. The FBI agents had somebody who was a friend of the defendant talking with them, and they were looking over her shoulder and telling her what to write. The converse of that is sometimes true in state law. So in the Lewinsky case, Linda Tripp got in trouble because she, without Monica Lewinsky's knowledge, tape recorded her. And since Virginia and California, where I practice, are dual party or all party consent states, everybody who's being tape recorded, everybody who's being monitored needs to know. And since Linda didn't let Monica in on it, she was potentially in trouble in Virginia. So that's why.
And my other question relates to the music industry, where they were gathering forensics information about who's taking music, downloading it, people, things like that. Why is that not prohibited?
Okay, so the question number one was, what if you're in a single-party consent state and you're taping somebody who's in a dual-party consent state? Well, that's a great question. I mean, these jurisdictional issues are really complicated, and they get more complicated when you go internationally. You know, the general rule is that the way we treat is you're subject to the laws of the state you're physically present in. But there's also another rule which says if your actions affect or harm somebody in another state, and if you have sufficient contacts with that state, then you could be brought into that other state and be held responsible under their laws as well. So, you know, it depends on some other facts. It's like a maybe, maybe not thing. And this is one of the complexities of the, it's just one of the complexities of the law. If you're in a single party consent state, though, I think just like the, you know, mostly people think, well, I'm here in the single party consent state, so that's all I need. That's generally the rule, but there are arguments where you could bring somebody into it and hold them responsible for the laws under the dual party consent state. Now, your second question was about the how, like, the RIAA is getting information about people who are file sharing. Is that right? Over networks like, okay. So my understanding of how they do their investigation is they go, the RIAA, not a government agency, goes to the ISP and says to the ISP, we've got these IP addresses, we want you to tell us who had this IP address at that time. So we're not talking about interception of the content of communications there. There we're talking about obtaining transactional information, which we're going to get to in a little bit, if we're lucky. Okay, so one of the other, another exception, the computer trespasser exception. This is new under the Patriot Act. This says that the government can monitor a trespasser if the provider says it's okay, and if you're only monitoring communications to and from the trespasser. So if I'm talking with the bad guy, my communications are going to get intercepted, even though I didn't do anything, because they're communications to and from. And all that the government needs is reasonable grounds to believe that the information is relevant to an ongoing legitimate investigation. Okay. One of the things that's interesting about this exception, which we'll talk about a little bit more when we get to the question of what's unauthorized access to computers under the federal law, is this first point, which is that it specifically says that the trespasser is only a trespasser if he has no contractual relationship or authority whatsoever to be on the computer. So we're talking about somebody with no right to be there whatsoever. And why did Congress put that in? Well, they recognized that you could be considered a trespasser under federal law if you were a legitimate customer of the ISP, but you were violating your terms of service or some other kind of contractual relationship with the ISP. And they didn't want customers who were violating their terms of service to lose all their rights under the Wiretap Act, all their privacy rights. So they said, we're not talking about these kinds of people who are just, you know, breaking their contract. We're talking about people who have no right to be there whatsoever. I think it's too bad that they don't have a similar conception in the unauthorized access law, because there, if you violate your terms of service and your use of the computer therefore thereby becomes unauthorized or beyond what the ISP authorized you to do, you can get in trouble under the federal law there. So I will see, as we go through some of those cases there, you'll see how that can be a real problem. And I believe that violations of contract should not be crimes. Yes. If you're an individual and you're sniffing inbound traffic on your network,
right? Somebody else is coming in, right? My network. I'm sniffing the traffic and recording that information. So essentially, I'm, violating because I'm not making them aware that I'm offering.
You may not be violating it because you may be okay under the service provider exception. Okay, so I'll get there in a second. So consent, the person agrees. And how do we get consent? There's basically two ways. One is terms of service can say that you've agreed, or there can be warning banners which say all activity on this system is subject to monitoring. These are imperfect because not all intruders are going to see the warning banner, and not all the people who communicate with the intruders are going to know that there's a warning banner or that any kind of consent has been given. But this is a way that people show consent for the under the Wiretap Act. You guys both back there have a question about this? Yes, gentlemen in the hat. There have not been cases. He's asking me about operating system licenses, and as many of you probably know, there are some really onerous terms in some of these operating system and software licenses. We can search your computer for other software of ours that's that's infringing, those kinds of things. And those terms in contracts have not been tested in the courts as of yet. I know that there was a case in New York that the New York Attorney General, had brought challenging some of these really outrageous, no reverse engineering, no comparing our product with other products type of terms, but there is not a clear sense of whether those kinds of license terms are going to be enforceable or not. The law on that is not good, because we tend to think that parties, you know, there's sort of like a mythology that parties contract to at arm's length. Each person has, or party has, the ability to just say, no, I'm not going to enter into that contract. I don't have to buy this software. I can go buy some other software. I'm not obligated to do so, and if I agree, then I should be held to what I agree to. There's a converse to that, which is when it comes to software, sometimes you don't have much of a choice, and nobody reads those licenses, and the company has an immense amount of bargaining power compared to the individual and all of that. So that's sort of untested. We don't know. And the gentleman right behind you had a question. Yeah, so that is what people argue. You know, we had our systems bannered. Just because we didn't banner the illegal way doesn't mean that it wasn't clear to any legitimate user that we monitor. I think your argument would be, well, you know, if you're a computer trespasser, you could then try to fit it in under the computer trespasser exception. You could say, I don't need to have consent because I've got the computer trespasser exception that applies here. But that's why warning banners are kind of imperfect. Okay, the service provider exception is the broadest exception, and it's the one, I don't want to say it's the broadest, but it's the one that may be most relevant for people here. Basically, it says that the provider of a service can monitor their own service to protect their rights or property, and that they can intercept communications if it's inherently necessary as part of providing the service. Now, exactly what this means is undefined. There haven't been a lot of cases on this that have tested this, but this is the exception that most service providers are looking to when they're saying this is what we, you know, this is why we're doing monitoring. Now, the statute specifically says you can't do random monitoring unless it's for mechanical checks or quality control or that kind of thing, but otherwise you can do monitoring of your system. So if you are going to do this and you're not using a banner and you don't do it as a regular course, you might want to consult with a lawyer who's going to take a close look at the statute and your circumstances and see if you're going to fit in under the service provider exception. Now, if you find something that's important or interesting or relevant to the investigation that shows that a crime's happening, then can you tell law enforcement? Well, yes, disclosure of these communications that you legitimately find is okay. If you either inadvertently obtained them or legitimately obtained them, and if they appear to pertain to the commission of a crime, then you're allowed to tell law enforcement. Okay? So, can you say it again? Service provider is defined. It's I'll just read you this part of the statute. It's operator of a switchboard, officer, employee, agent, or agent of a provider of wire or electronic communication service. Whose facilities are used in the transmission of a wire or electronic communication. And they define further in the statute electronic communication and all of that. This gentleman in the blue. So you're saying, what if I accidentally am monitoring other people's communications? I've heard this before. You know, the statute says that if they're inadvertently obtained, if the content of communication are inadvertently obtained, you're okay. But you want to be really careful that you're not monitoring or intercepting communications that are not that don't fit in under one of these exceptions. That's, I think, one of the responsibilities of service providers. And while I understand that that is something that is difficult to do, it's definitely something you want to be careful to try not to do, because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to fall afoul of these rules. One more question in the back. Right. So his question is a good one. It's about chain of custody issues, and what do I do about chain of custody? Well, this is why when you do any kind of investigation, or you know, whatever your agent, your business or your company is, you should have in place procedures for doing these kinds of investigations. Chain of custody doesn't mean that the government has to have had the evidence the whole time. Chain of custody means that you have to be able to demonstrate that the evidence that you're presenting in court is the same thing as the evidence that was collected from the computer at the time, and that it wasn't altered or lost or changed or somebody put OJ's DNA in it or anything like that. So you have to be, and that means you have to show step by step by step where it all was throughout the course of time and that nobody tampered with it. So it's not super hard to do. What you have to do, though, is you have to say, I'm the investigator, there's one person who does it, that's the person who accessed the computer at the time that there was the intrusion. Here's what I did, here's the evidence preserved in exactly that state, here's how I know it's exactly the same as what I downloaded on the day of the incident, and I gave it to the FBI agent, and the FBI agent can say, this is exactly what I got from him, and you're just tracing it and showing that it is the same thing. You know, the human's testimony that this is the same thing works pretty good. I think that a lot of people, a lot of technology people, would like there to be like a MD5 checksum on it, and you know, be able to show it's exactly the same and everything. But normally, if the police, if the FBI agent says, you know, he gave me the hard drive and I put it in this manila envelope and I sealed it with the red tape and that's my signature and it looks the same to me, that's going to basically be good enough to get it into evidence. And then at that point, the defense attorney is going to have to say, yeah, but here's all the things that could have happened. This happened to me actually once in a case that I was working on where they introduced log files, and the log files were edited down to get, you know, the good stuff and wasn't the complete log file. And I said to the person who was on the stand, I said, you know, these aren't the original log files that you got from the system, are they? So yeah, these are the log files. This isn't the full log file, is it? No, you edited this, didn't you? Yes, he says. You cut and pasted what you thought was important. He said, yes. And the judge was like, wait. You mean like with a scissor? I knew then that the evidence was coming in, and I wasn't getting anywhere with that line of questioning. Yes. It was a couple years ago, but still, he should have known.
My question for you is, what happens if the service provider is, in fact, the government? Does that put extra limitation on what the government, because the government is the service provider, are they now acting as agents for the government under the Fourth Amendment, or are they allowed the same freedom to conduct either routine or random or whatever kind of investigations or testing their system along with a private commercial provider?
Yeah, so what if the government is your employer? Yes, then these rules apply. Just like when the government is your employer, the First Amendment applies to your employer because the government is your employer. Here, these rules do apply. So these rules about the government has a whole different sort of thing. But when you are invested, when the government is acting solely as an employer, then the government has the rights of employers. But the government still has to be careful to be acting solely as an employer and not as an investigator. And sometimes that line is going to be hard to draw if the government is both investigator and employer. And it gets even more complicated when the employer is not only the government, but is also the military, because the military has a whole bunch of other rules about when they're allowed to surveil citizens and that kind of thing. And so they have to be careful not to transgress any of these rules or any of those rules, you know, or the Fourth Amendment or any of that stuff. So, yes. Okay. All right, moving. Yes. No, not you, I'm sorry. Thank you. You know, it's interesting because I don't know that the courts think that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy with regards to their service provider. Take, for example, I would have thought I had a reasonable expectation of privacy with regards to my phone calls or who I call or that kind of thing. Or my banking records, I would think I have an expectation of privacy there. But what the law generally thinks is that if data, information about you, is in the hands of a third party, then you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it anymore, because that third party can tell whoever they want, unless there's statutes that prevent them from doing so. So I'm not sure that the law would even say you've got a reasonable expectation of privacy in the information that's on your ISP. And as you'll see, as we're gonna skip past this one because we already talked about it, as you'll see when we talk about stored communications, there are cases that say that your ISP can read your email. So there's one that just came out a couple of weeks ago that say it's okay for the ISP to read your email. I'll take one more question from you and then we'll move on.
Kind of playing with that, there's a lot of folks that are using TLS or managed VPN services, etc., to protect their company assets between locations. The service provider has this perception, or there's not an expectation of privacy. Is that really kind of a false sense of security that the company is garnering by expecting that Southwestern Bell or whoever the service provider is going to protect that data for them all?
Yeah, I mean, so you're talking about companies who are then relying on, like, the telecoms or something like that to transmit their data across the telephone lines. And I think that that's definitely right, because the telephone that you have to be careful about thinking that that information is really going to be private, because the telecom company has its own rights as a service provider to monitor for their, to protect their rights and their property. So yes, I think you cannot count on in the absence of any kind of contractual or other agreement, that they're going to not do any of that kind of monitoring. Okay, what about traffic analysis? So content of communications is protected really a lot. Traffic analysis is the to and from. What about that? Well, that's protected too, but it's not as well protected. There's a general prohibition against collecting in real time traffic data. Law enforcement needs a pen or pen register trap and trace order, which is a special kind of court order. And the service provider needs to fit in under an exception. The service provider, again, has an exception. Service provider can get this traffic data if it relates to the operation of the service, if it's for protection of the rights or property of the provider, or to just record the fact that calls were made and completed for billing purposes and that kind of thing. And finally, also consent of the user. So this is very similar, general prohibition with exceptions. The difference is that it's a lot easier. It's easier to get because the information is not considered as sensitive or as private. Okay. What about if the intruders left files or something on your system or on an intermediary system or on his or her own system, and you know that the files are there and that they're going to be helpful in your investigation? Can you go and get those? Okay, so stored data stored information is treated differently from information in transit. We've decided to treat stored data and think of it as less private than information that's in transit. There is a general prohibition. It's illegal to access stored communications without or in excess of authorization. So access a facility which provides electronic communication services without authorization or in excess of authorization, and obtain the contents of communications there, that is prohibited. That's a crime and not allowed. But the access to the communications itself doesn't necessarily have to be specifically authorized by the person whose communications they are, either the recipient or the sender. So what exactly does that mean? Well, what it means is that the provider has a right to review communications or information, the substance of communications that are stored on their system. So providers can read stored emails that are on the system. There's not unauthorized access to the system here. And there was a case very recently on this. It's United States versus Councilman. It's particularly galling to me. I'll tell you why in a moment. But in the Councilman case, they charged, basically, this was a book seller, and they wanted to know what books people who had email accounts on their system were buying and selling, because they wanted to go into the book business. So basically what they did was they made copies of every email from Amazon.com to the people who were on their system, and they put those copies away, and they were going to do an analysis of it and figure out what books they were selling, maybe for competitive reasons, maybe not, whatever. And the government charged them with violating the Wiretap Act, with intercepting communications in transit. And the defense that Mr. Councilman's excellent attorney raised was that these communications were not in transit, they were stored, because they were accessing them. The emails come in, at the point that they come in and they hit the server, the ISP or the email server, the one copy was made for the company, one copy was sent to the intended recipient. And so they weren't in transit, they were already in storage, if only in temporary storage on the email server. And the court said that that was right, that this wasn't a violation of the Wiretap Act. It was not a violation, and they couldn't go then to this law, which prevents access to stored communications, because you have to access the facility without authorization, not the communication without authorization of either the sender or the recipient. The reason why the case really bothers me is because I represented Mr. Councilman's co-defendant, and I pled him guilty, so I shouldn't have done that. I should have hung on and waited, and then I would have had this great ruling, and I would have been in good shape, but I didn't do that. That was like 4 years ago. We should have hung in there, but we didn't. So then, once you have this information, what can you do with it? Well, a non-public provider, in other words, not like a Earthlink or an ISP that sells services to the public, but like an employer, can freely disclose the information that they find there if they want to.
What if the user deleted it, but, I mean, it was still stored at one time, or
if the user deleted it, but it's backed up on the service provider system, that you can read it. The employer can read it. You have very few rights in the United States against your employer, because in the United States, our privacy laws are targeted towards protecting us from the government, which is a very different viewpoint from how other countries look at privacy there. They may look at privacy as something where it protects you from your employer, it protects you from private industry. They are okay with government access. But ours is really focused on the government. You have very few privacy rights in the workplace.
Okay.
Yes, then you. So yes, and he's asking me, what about if you have a EULA or Terms of Service which says we're not going to do this? And again, there haven't been cases that have really tested the enforceability of provisions in the EULA. And generally, you know, these aren't really great privacy-protecting documents, because often they'll say, well, never sell your data unless we change our mind, and we can change our mind without telling you. Or we can change our mind and tell you, but then you have to opt out or something like that. But let's say you had a real contract that said, we're not going to ever disclose your data to anyone so long as, you know, it doesn't make us criminals to hide you. Let's say it's something like that. You could probably enforce that EULA. But your remedy would be under contract law. You have an agreement with your provider, and your remedy would be a contract remedy. You would get the monetary value of whatever that private information was worth and how much you lost by its disclosure, which can sometimes be hard to prove or figure out what it is. It's quite a bit different from if these laws are violated with, you know, in the absence of contract, because many of these laws, if you violate them, the information can't be used in court. And there's criminal penalties and there's civil penalties as well. So it's quite a bit different, but your remedy would be under contract law. Yes?
What's that test of Test.com, though? They were able to sell off their email list as a commodity to, as they were going under, to offset some of their bankruptcy costs, something like that?
Yeah, so a lot of, during the dot-com crash, a lot of companies were selling their customer list, and you know, customers could have gone against them if the EULA was enforceable and didn't say something like, we can change our mind. A lot of them said, we're not going to sell your data unless we change our mind. And I knew people who were working at dot-com, so were like, we're sending out a message to people that says in legalese, we're changing our mind and we're going to, because we know we're going under. So that kind of thing, definitely happened. Carol.
What about a situation where you send out email and accidentally send it to the wrong address and it contains contains a lot of proprietary private data. Now, the person receiving it at the other end, you had no control over receiving it. You might have a privacy banner on the bottom or something, but can they then disclose it?
Right, so the question is, what if your email gets misdirected and you've sent private information to the wrong person, even if you have, well, you know, a lot of times you'll have this information is only intended for blah, blah, blah. So I don't think, my opinion, we don't have any cases on this either, my opinion is those are not enforceable. Here's why, because contract requires two parties to agree, and when you send me an email that says you agree to not disclose this email to anybody else, I may not have agreed. So if I don't agree, I'm not bound to whatever you tell me about it. And if the information is not protected for some other legal reason, in other words, it's a trade secret or it's copyrighted or something like that, then I think I can disclose it. So I don't think that those things would necessarily be true. The fact that there's a notice there, however, may put people on notice that it is a trade secret or it is something that is protected and can then help show that the person knew or should have known that they shouldn't have been disclosing the information, which can be helpful later on. But my opinion, untested by the courts, is that those little warning banners at the bottom of email are not necessarily going to do any real good if it gets in the hands of somebody who doesn't feel like cooperating with you by helping keep the information private. Okay, one more question from you, and then we'll move on. You can pick one. You know, this is funny because it's interesting. He's asking, well, what if it says you can only manifest your failure to consent by contacting us or sending it back? Otherwise, it means that you did consent. And it's interesting because a lot of the licensing agreements that we see these days are like that. They say, you know, by clicking here, you agree, or by continuing to use this website, it means that you've agreed to our terms and conditions. I've even seen one that says, by reading this legal notice, you've agreed to our terms and conditions. And these have not, as I said, these have not been tested in the court, but I think that these are going to be unlikely to be sufficient manifestations of people's real consent. There has to be some manifestation of consent. And yes, like, clicking here, clicking OK may do it, but I don't think the browse wrap, like you just read it and continued to use, or something like that, which requires you to actually do something to say no, I don't think that those are going to fly. That's my opinion. You can ask it, and then I'll decide if I want to answer it now. So could I go to, if I have a contract and somebody is doing something in violation of the contract, can I go to court and get an injunction? The quick answer to that is yes, you could. It's hard to get an order forcing someone to comply with a contract, but it is possible. It's harder to do that than to just get money for violation of the contract. Okay. Let me just say one other thing about the general prohibition, accessing without authorization or in excess of authorization, because I think you guys, we only have a little bit of time, but I think you guys are going to really like this. So there's this case also recent that came down which said that, which involves lawyers. And these lawyers were in litigation with these other people and they decided they wanted their emails. So they sent this subpoena, which the court said was patently unlawful. Anybody would know the subpoena was way overbroad. Send us all the emails that these guys ever sent to anybody, the lawyers said. And the ISP, a small kind of ISP, was like, well, we can't send you everything, but here, take these. So the people whose emails were subpoenaed were like, you can't use this bad subpoena for this. And they sued the lawyers, saying you violated this law because you got unauthorized access to our email communications. And the lawyer said, well, we didn't access them, the ISP did, and it wasn't without authorization. We had this subpoena, even though the court later found that the subpoena was invalid. So, you know, we're just getting the information, and the ISP could have objected at any time. You know, don't look at us. And what the Ninth Circuit said which is the appellate court that governs Nevada and California and many of our other states that are out here. The Ninth Circuit said it is a violation of this law to use a patently unlawful subpoena to get somebody's email records out of storage on an ISP. You don't have to necessarily be the one to go into the machine and pull the information out. You can, under the color of law, but without any actual legal authority, get somebody else to do that for you, and you can be responsible for violating this law, accessing these communications without authorization. This is a ruling, the case is Theofal versus Ferry Jones, and this is a ruling that privacy people love, because privacy people don't want people subpoenaing other people's email with patently unlawful, invalid subpoenas. It's a ruling that criminal people like myself hate, because criminal people like myself are very concerned, though we love privacy, we're also very concerned about expanding the definition of unauthorized access or access in excess of authorization to include all sorts of things as criminal violations. Issuing a patently unlawful subpoena is bad, but I don't think it should be a crime. So just to give you some idea of the debates that are ongoing in this area. Okay, we talked about the provider. Disclosure. A public provider can access and disclose non-content records. We're talking about subscriber information to anyone except the government. So again, you see here how we have this view in the United States where we could protect ourselves from government scrutiny. There are exceptions. You can disclose to the government to protect the provider's rights and property. Again, we're seeing this service provider exception. You can disclose if the information relates to threat of death or serious bodily injury. This is something added by the Patriot Act. You can disclose with appropriate legal process, or you can disclose with the consent of the subscriber. Okay. So, quick and dirty, that was basically the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And it's a complicated statute, but if you have some idea of it there, I think that we did pretty well. The upshot is, before accessing information that is on your network, you're likely to be able to do it as under the service provider exception, but you have to be very careful and you should consult with a lawyer. As for accessing information which is stored on other people's computer networks, a big problem. Not only because you're accessing the content of communications or because you're accessing stored communications without authorization, perhaps, but also because maybe you are violating the anti-hacking law. So what about accessing some other computer systems, not your own? Can you disable a system that's sending you malicious code? Can you install monitoring programs? Can you gain access to remote access to a system in order to search it for information? Okay. There's a law in the United States that prohibits unauthorized access to computers. It's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, located at 18 U.S.C. Section 1030, and here's a brief little summary of what it says. Other countries have versions of this law, and many states have their own version of this law as well. Now, we talked a little bit before about the concept of unauthorized access, and as I said, it's been interpreted very broadly. These are things that have been interpreted by courts as being unauthorized access to computers. Spam, search robots, spiders, price aggregators or shopping bots, and cookies. These are all things which have been considered unauthorized access. Now, if you look at the cases, not in every case do people get in trouble for these things, because not in every case did people actually meet this definition of damage. To be a violation under the federal law, you need not only the unauthorized access, but also loss. Okay? So in a lot of these cases, there wasn't necessarily loss, but there was unauthorized access because somebody didn't want you sending these electrons to their machine. And I think this is really important to keep in mind whenever we talk about getting rid of the loss element in Section 1030. The loss element is the thing that's preventing these kinds of things from being crimes. Okay? The cookies were challenged in a case, and the court said that cookies are problematic, but there's no damage. Cookies are unauthorized access. What about port scanning? There's another one. Well, there is one case that's considered port scanning. We're all familiar with the different metaphors that people use to say, well, either port scanning's bad or port scanning's, perfectly fine. But there's one case that considered it. The case was Moulton versus BC3, and they said, yes, port scanning is unauthorized access because you're sending these unwanted packets to this machine, but there's no damage, so it's not going to be a violation of this particular federal statute. I think that that ruling is wrong. I think that the ruling should, I think that we need to refocus attention on what's unauthorized access as opposed to is there damage or is there not damage, and that unauthorized access should be something more than sending harmless packets to open ports. It should perhaps, it should involve circumvention of some kind of security measure, thank you, or it should involve some kind of, some kind of other sort of attack, but any kind of unwanted packet, like I don't want your spam, or I don't want your search robot crawling my site, or that kind of thing, there should be something more than that to distinguish between criminal and non-criminal behavior. The gentleman over there.
What about the case where port scanning disables the system? I mean, those things are so gentle and they don't even touch us. These devices can disable the system. But what in the case of a Nessus scan that disables, say, APMs? Would that be a violation?
Well, the statute, if you fit the other elements of the statute, which is that you knowingly and intentionally cause unauthorized access and